A wallet stolen in a hotel bathroom. Gold flakes stirred into morning coffee. A PowerPoint presentation that captures a family's essence. In Jennifer Egan's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, these seemingly disconnected moments form an intricate web of human experience spanning decades. Time, what one character calls the Goon Squad, is the true protagonist, transforming rebellious teenagers into nostalgic adults and punk rockers into corporate executives. The novel's brilliance lies in its kaleidoscopic structure, shifting perspectives across characters whose lives intersect in unexpected ways. Rather than following a traditional narrative arc, we witness fragments of lives that gradually coalesce into a profound meditation on how we change and how we remain fundamentally the same as years pass. Like memory itself, the story unfolds non-chronologically, revealing how past experiences shape present identities in ways both subtle and dramatic. What happens between point A and point B in a life? And can we ever truly understand the transformation? Sasha's apartment functions as a private museum, a kitchen bathtub and drawers meticulously organized with stolen items, a child's scarf, hotel soaps, a wallet from the Losimo Hotel. Each object represents her attempt to freeze time, to possess moments that would otherwise disappear. During therapy with Coase, she avoids examining why she needs these fragments of others' lives. When showing Alex her collection, the items transform into stories: a handkerchief from a crying woman, miniature soap from Paris. Taking a folded note reading, "I believe in you," from Alex's wallet, she steals not just paper, but sentiment, borrowed faith she cannot generate herself. Her kleptomania fights against time's relentless flow, mirroring our own attempts to preserve memories through photographs or souvenirs. Each item becomes meaningful through her obsessive attention. Her admission that, "it's a problem, but I'm getting help," reveals both self-awareness and dependence on a behavior that gives her rare control. How do we reconcile who we once were with who we've become? Benny Salazar, former punk rocker turned successful music producer, adds gold flakes to his coffee, an Aztec remedy for waning potency, as his cultural relevance fades. His mornings are haunted by shame memories, kissing a mother superior, being called a hairball by colleagues, his son getting lice at his expensive private school. The former mosh pit thrasher now drives a Porsche through suburban streets, perpetually out of place. His son Christopher remains distant during weekly visits, more absorbed in handheld games than his father's attempts at connection. When Benny takes Christopher to visit the Stop Go sisters in Queens, their harmonies briefly reconnect him with his youthful passion. This illusion shatters when his assistant Sasha reveals the truth. The sisters were terrible, and his last visit wasn't 2 years ago, but five, just before 9/11. Driving into Manhattan, Benny plays increasingly older music, expressing his disillusionment, while Sasha stares at the empty space where the Twin Towers once stood. Through green-haired Rhea's perspective, we witness the formation of identities that shape the novel's adult characters. The Flaming Dildos, a high school punk band with ever-changing names, reveals a chain of unrequited desire. Rhea wants Benny, who wants Alice, who wants Scotty, who wants Jocelyn, who wants Lou, an adult who picked her up hitchhiking. At the Mabuhay Gardens, the teens slam dance with real punks, their mingled sweat making them feel almost authentic. This quest for authenticity drives everything from Rhea's green hair to their screamed lyrics. Landing a gig at the MAB feels momentous. Young Benny becomes the gold flake-consuming music executive. Scotty emerges as the reclusive genius with his handmade lap steel guitar. Jocelyn, entangled with older Lou, begins a pattern of self-destruction. The section climaxes when Lou takes both girls to dinner, where Rhea watches helplessly as he forces himself on Jocelyn while keeping his arm around Rhea. Later, discovering Lou has six children, including a son their age, reveals his predatory nature. Lou's African safari with his children, Charlie and Rolf, and his 23-year-old girlfriend, Mindy, reveals deep family dysfunction. Mindy observes them with academic detachment, theorizing about structural hatred while awkwardly navigating her dual role as girlfriend and surrogate mother. When Kronos, a bassist from Lou's band, is attacked by a lioness after approaching too closely, the incident becomes entertainment rather than prompting reflection, exposing the family's warped values. Egan brilliantly employs flash forwards, showing Charlie's future in a cult and cocaine addiction before becoming a corporate lawyer who names her son after her brother. More devastating is sensitive Rolf's fate, his genuine concern for orphaned lion cubs contrasted with his suicide at 28, which shadows every present interaction. Charlie and Rolf's dance on their final night becomes poignant, knowing it will become Charlie's cherished memory after losing her brother. Rolf's comment about birdwatching ladies, actually Lou's conquests, reveals his growing awareness of adult deception while foreshadowing his inability to reconcile with such a compromised world. 20 years after the wild parties, Jocelyn and Rhea visit their dying former mentor. Lou lies frail in a hospital bed, his house now an eerily quiet museum to an irretrievable past. Jocelyn, 43, lives with her mother after desultory 20s, still pursuing her BA. The years with Lou derailed her potential. When she asks about Rolf, Lou breaks down crying. She'd forgotten his suicide, an old tragedy everyone else remembers. Their confrontation distills the novel's themes. When she tells him, "I should kill you, you deserve to die," Lou simply responds, "Too late." This exchange captures how time denies justice or closure. Lou has already been sentenced by time itself, the goon squad that reduces even the powerful to helplessness. When he asks them to stand beside him at the pool, his manipulative charm still commands their compliance, showing how the past shapes our present in ways we only understand when forced to confront it. In the final chapter, Alex meets Benny to discuss recruiting parrots to generate authentic word of mouth for Scotty Houseman's concert, brilliantly capturing anxieties about social media influence and commodified experiences. Benny's assistant Lulu dismisses Alex's ethical concerns as atavistic purism, revealing generational shifts in attitudes toward authenticity. For this confident graduate student, ethical ambivalence merely justifies doing what one secretly desires. The concert becomes an unexpected triumph when Scotty delivers a performance evolving from simple songs to powerful ballads of paranoia and disconnection. His music represents something genuine in a world of manufactured experiences. Afterward, Alex asks if Benny ever employed Sasha. The name hangs incandescent between them, as Benny confirms she was his assistant before firing her for stealing. At her old building, Alex recalls their brief encounter years earlier. Their unanswered ring at her buzzer represents connections lost to time. Alex realizes his longing for Sasha is actually nostalgia for his younger self. As they leave, Benny states, "You grew up, Alex, just like the rest of us." The novel ends with Alex hearing the hum of time passing.